Welcome to the Vet Podcast by the vet gurus, Brendan and Mark. Get ready for the latest veterinary news, information and entertainment. Don't forget to visit us at the Vet Gurus website, vetgurus.com. Now, sit back, relax. It's over to the Vet Gurus, Brendan and Mark.
Welcome to episode 339, Thursday, March the 28th, 2024. Brendan here with Mark. Mark, how are you? Good, I hope.
Wonderful, Brendan. It's really hot and humid where I'm at the moment, but I'm good.
We've had a little bit of a cool snap, although perfect sort of weather as far as I'm concerned, sort of 20 to 25 or so degrees Celsius here and some beautiful sunny days. So I can't complain at all, Mark. Just the right temperature to get out and about. And as we had a bit of a chat offline, we had a bit of a visitor from a colleague I went through university with, Mark, and shout out to Mark if he listens to the podcast, which I don't think he does, but I'll let him know. We've done a shout out today, a veterinary cardiologist from the USA who came and stayed with us for a few days and during his trip. And yeah, we had a good day yesterday, as I mentioned to you, Mark. We wandered out to a winery or two and spent a full day with him yesterday, and he stayed two or three days. And yeah, we had. It was great to catch up. Hadn't seen him for probably 5+ years, mate.
It is. It's always good to catch up. But isn't it funny? As I've gotten older, so many of those connections that I made when I was very young that because I'm an utter bastard, I've neglected and not kept up with. They've become more and more important. Like, you know, visiting the people I went to uni with, contacting them, the people I went to school with. It's good that you got a chance to catch up with Mark while he was here.
Yes, it was good. And this being our Easter special, Mark, I've just finished. I didn't tell you this. I'll just send you a picture. I've just finished making some hot cross buns.
Nice.
Yeah, so I've just they're just cooling on the wire rack. I've just sent you a pic of them. You might get it in a sec.
I've got it now. They look yummy. Very scrummy.
I've just glazed them with a little bit of apricot glaze over the top there. So after we finish recording, Mark, I'm going to munch down on a couple of them, I think. So, yes, I'm looking forward to that. So hurry up, and I need to get out and eat my hot cross buns. So happy Easter, if you celebrate Easter or you have a holiday. And we here in Australia, we have a couple of public holidays, Mark, don't we, over the Easter period. So we have this Friday is a public holiday, and the Monday is a public holiday. So basically a very long weekend. I am working on Saturday morning, but otherwise there's a couple of extra days off. And I know Easter's a very, very busy time for people to take time off, Mark, and it's usually extremely popular for people to head out, and I think same anywhere in Australia, head out to things like the caravan parks and camping, especially,
yes,
isn't it, Mark?
It is a famous time of year to go camping.
And I, you know what I'm like, I'm averse to people, so I just don't like the crowd, so we never really tried to head off during the Easter period. We'd sort of hunker down at home and just have a bit of a relaxing time at home rather than fighting the crowds at the tourist destinations. But hopefully the weather's not too bad, because the other classic with Easter sometimes is that, you know, the people out, lots of people camping, and there's horrendous torrential rain or storms or something that goes on. So hopefully we don't get that for those people camping, Mark.
It is a wonderful time of year to get out, like, you know, just starting to get a little bit cooler and not that massive
heat. Autumn here in the southern hemisphere, yes.
But it is, I am fascinated by, like you, I try and avoid the crowds, and some of those camping sites just look like suburbia without all the amenities and privacy. And so, yeah, I'm with you.
They end up looking like a, you know, one of those concert, little sort of, you know, that they have in the fields, you know. And yeah, a bit of a disaster sometimes, I think. But yeah, not my scene, Mark, but I'm sure. Well, a lot of people seem to enjoy it, so yes. And I think with that, I don't have a review this week, Mark. Do you have anything?
No, not this week.
Well, I'm going to jump into my news story in this one. One of our favourite animals, the Labrador Mark, a genetic mutation in a quarter of all Labradors hardwires them for obesity, as if they didn't already like their food, Mark. So it's a mutation in a gene that they've determined, the POMC gene, which plays a critical role in hunger and energy use in about 25% of Labradors and 66% of flat-coated retriever dogs have this mutation. So interestingly enough, the way the mutation works, it also has a double whammy, Mark, that the dogs with this mutation gene were found to use around 25% less energy at rest than dogs without it. So they don't need many calories, even though they've got a Labrador appetite as well. And it also seems to make the dogs hungrier. So affected dogs, according to the article, which we'll link to at vetgurus.com, affected dogs tend to overeat because they get hungry between meals more quickly than dogs without the mutation. So, gee, as if it isn't. And as you know, Mark, I had a Labrador who lived to 17, old Boof, we called her. And yeah, she was a classic Labrador, loved everybody and certainly loved her food, and it was always a battle with her. So I don't know whether this helps much, because it's just another reason why it's a bit of a struggle to keep the weight off the old Labradors, mate.
It's interesting too that that article points out that the POMC gene is also it's a gene that's shared in dogs and humans.
Yes.
And so the human, there are humans who have this gene who tend to become obese at an early age and develop a host of clinical problems as a result. So it's interesting that there's that that corollary between species. But certainly intuitively you would have thought that if there was a gene that decreased basal metabolic rate and increased hunger, your Labrador is going to have it.
Yes. So I love Labs. They're such cute dogs. So I could see myself having another Labrador in the future, and perhaps it'll be on one of those obesity prevention, you know, medication. So I suppose one of the positives there, Mark, as you mentioned, with the crossover with humans, is that I expect that they'll probably use Labradors as a study model for the drugs that they're using in humans
to control it. Speaking of rapid weight gain, that's my segue, Brendan.
Yes.
I want to talk about baby Sicilians. Sicilians are legless rainforest amphibians. They look vaguely, I suppose, snake-like because they don't have any legs, maybe worm-like,
yeah.
But they're most closely related to frogs, of course. And a recent publication in Science highlights that the ringed Sicilian mothers feed their hatchlings, the babies, a kind of milk, a secretion of the oviduct, particularly rich in lipids, the baby Sicilians make exceptional weight gains over the first few weeks of life, and nobody could sort of explain why. But now it appears that they bulk up their mass by 130% in the first week out of the egg, despite not leaving their mother's side. And they feed on her skin, where the milky exudate resides, only once every few days. So, wow, that's and it's
yes.
Really interesting in that, you know, we've considered milk production a bit of a marker for mammalian life forms, you know, if they produce milk. But the Sicilians just add to a range of species, spiders, fish, some cockroaches, some birds, and that produce some milk-like substance, a version of milk to supplement the feeding and growth of their scorpions, that supplement their young with a secretion from their mother. So milk isn't as unique to mammals as we maybe once thought.
Yes, it's a fascinating article, this one, and we'll link to this one as well. And they, I just found it amazing that they also squeak and beg. According, you know, it's the terms and the wording they used. The youngsters there trying to, you know, attract mum to secrete or exude some more of that milk mark. Fascinating creatures. Bit of a crossover creature, I think.
Do they nuzzle out, and do they act that? There is a recording with that article, and I wonder if it has. The sounds are thought, because the adults are thought to be sensitive only to low sound frequencies. Maybe we won't be able to hear it on that bit of video.
They react to subwoofers, Mark. yes. There we go. There are two news articles, Mark. And regarding unusual and weird animals, Mark, that's a good intro to our main topic, which I thought we'd have a little bit of a chat about illegal exotic pets or illegal exotic and unusual pets. So we need to define what we're talking about here, Mark. Do you want to have a crack at that?
I will. It is a little bit of a jurisdictionally determined, you know, what's illegal in New South Wales, here in Australia, might be different to Queensland or Victoria. And, of course, once you start distinguishing some of the countries that our podcast goes to, the rules are going to be very, very different wherever you are. But there are, by most wildlife authorities, most government wildlife authorities around the world, attempts to limit, to some extent, the presence of animals that are not there routinely in that country, and so there's some degree of sanction against animals, particularly where I'm thinking of reptiles. And what then the consequence of this that's interesting to me is that we have had a number of times people come to the hospital with animals that, whether they be reptiles or birds, that they know are illegal, but they're seeking care for those animals, and it puts the veterinary practice in a very difficult position, whichever jurisdiction you're in. Isn't that the case, Brendan?
It certainly does, and I think the one of the things I wanted to chat about that, Mark, is you know, why are they classified as illegal exotic pets? And there's certainly very good reasons why, in depending on which species and which country, etc. Yeah, as you mentioned. And the two main reasons there, Mark, are the potential introduction of exotic diseases, Mark, with illegal importing of these pets that are just, you know, smuggled in. And secondly, the potential threat to the native animals, Mark, especially if they get out there in the wild. And, you know, there's certainly lots of examples of that. And the classic one that I always think of, because we see a few of them brought into us, Mark, is the red-eared slider turtles, Mark, which are a very invasive species here in Australia, and they compete and they breed quite readily, and they're very, very aggressive with competing with in the environment with other species. So that's a classic example. So there's very good reasons in virtually every single case why, you know, because in the Wild West, Mark, in a country where there may be no restrictions on keeping any type of pet, they may be thinking, so a listener in those areas may be thinking, gee, why are you restricting certain animals? Why can't I have a tiger, a lion, a Tasmanian tiger, a whatever, Mark.
Yeah, well, can I think we in Australia, it's more uppermost in our mind, in our consciousness, because of our unique circumstance, Brendan, our island state.
Distance.
Distance. And so we are insulated. The current avian influenza outbreak, we're managing to avoid the worst of it at the moment because of our isolation and our quarantine. And so there genuinely is reason to limit those species to the benefit of animal welfare and society at large. whether it's invasive species that compromise the habitat of threatened wildlife or those diseases, exotic diseases that might be introduced with those illegal animals. Very, very good reasons not to have it happen.
Yes, and despite that, humans being humans, we may have a phone call to our clinic with somebody with an illegal exotic pet, and yeah, classically here it's the reptiles or the birds, Mark.
Yep.
So somebody rings up and says, "I have a chameleon, or I have a Burmese python, or a boa constrictor, etc." It is unwell. Can I bring it to the vet clinic to be seen? And that's where the difficulty starts, doesn't it? We need to sort of step back. If we're a clinic that's dealing with unusual pets, exotic pets, we need to have a policy.
Yes.
And make decisions even before that phone call, and have a chat as a team, and decide, will we see these animals? And if we do see them, what's our approach to it? What's our education, I suppose, of that client when they arrive, and chatting to them about the legalities or not of that particular animal in front of us, Mark. And again, this will vary between countries, but here in Australia, there is no specific sort of mandatory requirement, as far as I know. You can correct me if I'm incorrect, Mark, as far as reporting.
Look, it is interesting, Brendan, because I remember a discussion about 15 years ago at one of our UPAV conferences where this was discussed. And at that time, what you say now was universally true across Australia, that there was no mandatory reporting.
Yes.
And that most veterinarians could rely on, you know, where there's competing interests for the ethics of veterinarians. So let's
welfare of the animal.
Yes, that yes. takes precedence. If yes. you go to an authority and say, "I treated this illegal animal for the welfare of the animal," that takes, that supersedes yes. most other things. That's changed a little bit in a couple of jurisdictions in Australia, particularly in New South Wales, where biosecurity has, there's been with the bees and the varroa mite. Queensland has the red ants. There's been a number of incursions which have highlighted the danger of biosecurity failures, and it has recently, in the last few years, become mandatory for veterinary practices, veterinarians, and veterinary staff in New South Wales to report any illegal animal that they're aware of. It's no longer an elective thing. So that puts so as a consequence, what you say is exactly right. You need to have a policy in place. You need to have scripts for your staff, and maybe even some social media posts, so that it's you don't want someone showing up with a garbage bin and a boa constrictor, dumping it on the front counter and saying, "Oh, I'm here to have my boa constrictor looked at
by Dr. Mark." Yes,
because that puts everyone in a very dangerous situation where our responsibilities may quickly supersede our desire to protect the client and maintain the goodwill of the practice amongst, more generally, the reptile keeping or bird keeping
yes.
Communities.
And that's, that one of the added difficulties there is that you're always cognizant of the potential backlash when you have somebody present one of these animals, if you tell them no, you shouldn't have it, we're not going to see it, we're going to report you, then they might jump on the social media and blast yeah. the clinic. So it's a challenge, to put it mildly, isn't it? Even in jurisdictions like New South Wales, as you mentioned, where it now is mandatory to report them, Mark. So it's a tricky one, isn't it? And I've never quite understood why people, especially here in Australia, would would want to own these illegal pets because we have so many fantastic, beautiful animals that you can keep legally that we don't have the issues of, you know, potential disease introduction and competition with wildlife if they did escape and or breed in the wild.
It's so true, Brendan. I think we are so blessed in Australia, whether it's birds or reptiles. There are constraining rules, legislation in each jurisdiction around Australia. But if you're a person in Australia who wants to keep reptiles or birds, you can do it. And our selection of the ones that you can keep is unique around the world, but it's the nature of humans, isn't it? As soon as I love chameleons and I can't have one, so I must have one. The avarice of humans and the desire to do what they want, irrespective of the general good of the community, it's often a competition where the general good loses, isn't it?
Yep. Now, I want to look at two scenarios, Mark.
Yes, let's hear them.
Two scenarios. One is that this animal is presented to Dr. Mark's clinic, regardless of where you are, and you haven't had the opportunity to forewarn them, and it does have some issues that needs to be dealt with for the care of that animal, because there is a bit of a duty of care there, Mark. So let's walk through the approach of that one, Mark.
So the Biosecurity Act.
Let's say a wound, you know, a decent wound. Yeah. It burnt itself or something on its heating lamp or something.
Look, the actual condition is probably less important. I think that any painful condition, the veterinarian should provide analgesia and first aid. But what's most, the steps that are supposed to happen are that the DPI, the Department of Primary Industries, is informed of an illegal animal, and almost invariably they're going to instruct the veterinarian with that animal at that time to euthanize it. And then it would be submitted for a variety of testing to assess the risks that it presented for exotic diseases. And so I think that step of notifying the appropriate authorities and undertaking whatever action they require of you, that's the key thing that you have to do. You can, of course, you were hinting at by describing a particular health scenario, there's no restriction on providing that first aid until you can have a direction from, you know, it might take a day before the appropriate authority calls back and says, yes, euthanize and do this. And there are specific preparations once an animal has been euthanized for particular tests that need to be carried out. So it's important to follow those instructions, but there's no embargo on treating painful conditions so that the animal's comfortable until a decision is made about its disposition.
Yes. So that's getting back to you need to determine in your region what the legalities are, and it's very important, and then having that clinic-wide protocol, Mark. So,
and you're about to say this, I believe, so correct me if I'm wrong, but in other states in Australia, there is no mandate for veterinary practices to report that. And so you're right to hint at the staff meeting where all the staff have to be on board with whatever policy and protocol that the practice decides is going to be the one they go with.
Yes, and that may be, so that was the second scenario exactly that I was going to chat about or we would discuss, and that may be that our clinic policy is no, we've come together and had a chat about it and we do not want to see any of these animals under any circumstance, and that's what's conveyed to the client or the owner when they initially phone up there, Mark. But if, again, there's, I suppose, two scenarios there, they may still just lob on the door with that animal that needs treatment, or that you have a policy within the practice that, oh, look, that they need seen from a veterinary perspective, so we will do that, and potentially as part of that process we may try and educate the client. And that's where I think we need to have a little chat about that, Mark. And that's where I can't remember the last illegal pet that's come into my practice, Mark.
There was a time when it was quite a regular occurrence, with, like you said, the sliders, the chameleons, the boas, iguanas. It wasn't an uncommon occurrence, but like you, it's been a long time. So I think the rules have started to dig in, and people realise that it's not an appropriate thing to do.
Yes, and the concern there is, are they just going underground with it and not getting treatment? And that's the concern from a veterinary perspective, Mark. But before you, I know you want to chat to that point. But what I in the past have done, although we have seen a few recently, Mark, but that not as illegal pets, as because I do a little bit of work with the local department here. So these are the confiscated ones that need either assessing or treating, or unfortunately sometimes euthanizing. So, and that's education, and that I would be, initially be fairly gentle, but then, address the animal in front of me as well, and whatever treatment it requires, but also say, what the hell are you doing? Why are you living in fear that you'll get raided and keeping this illegal pet and risking the biosecurity of Australia when you could have all these amazing, wonderful animals that won't have that effect on the environment, and you can relax at home, not having.
I feel ambivalent about that, Brendan. I'll tell you why, because I think there's certain.
So
you there?
Yes.
Yep. So you, as a veterinarian, have a huge amount of knowledge and understanding and information, and for the large part, you should benefit financially by providing the service where you disseminate that appropriate information. In this circumstance, I get upset because I feel that. That veterinarians are being used by some government instrumentalities to distribute that information without any recompense. Like, we don't get any benefit from the government department for teaching people about that stuff. And oftentimes it's a situation that's full of conflict, and the conflict that normally would be directed at the government department or body that administers that legislation is sometimes transferred to the veterinary practice with no benefit other than that we're trying to do the right thing. And so I sort of feel like sometimes it's not always our job, but we're going to have to do it anyway because it's been, dumped on us that we're the point at which people look for care for those animals. And as a consequence, some of the legislation mandates that we need to do certain things to benefit society or whatever, but we don't get any benefit outside of just feeling good about doing the right thing by the animals and the people and trying to educate them in general about the best things that can happen for those animals.
Yes, yes. Well said. Well said. I mean, yeah, I get frustrated with the ones in the past where I have gone down that track of trying to explain the other side of the coin and educate them. In my words, I said previously, because I think a lot of them just. Have it just falls on deaf ears. Yes.
It is. and you say that what you say is quite right. Isn't there some things in our professional lives where you get a great sense of satisfaction from, you're not going to teach every person that you come into contact with, but when the light switches on in someone's eyes and they go, I can see what you're saying, and you know that as a consequence, that animal is going, you know, that person is always for the rest of their life going to be an advocate for that animal in a different way, that's very gratifying professionally. This is one of those situations where almost every person that you try to educate about this already has made up their mind, and you do feel a little bit deflated that you're beating your head against a brick wall. And often there is a bit of acrimony, and the whole interaction leads to a bit of a downer, I reckon.
Yes.
So I think that's what you started this all out by talking about preparation. And this is one, you know, at a staff meeting, what do we do as a practice? What are in our jurisdictions? What are our legal responsibilities? How are we going to manage this? So we distress the animals the least, the owners the least, and of course the staff the least.
Yes, it's a bit of a headache, isn't it, too, when we think about this? But I think it's one we needed to address, Mark.
Brendan, I've got a quick question for you about it before we finish up. The other thing that happened that happens to me is that very often these animals are associated with, well, how can I put this tactfully? The people who are prepared to take the risks with the animals often are prepared to take risks with other laws. And so it's not unheard. I've heard rumours of motorcycle clubs having collections of exotic reptiles and such like, and maybe people who are involved in the illegal drug trade having animals that are similarly illegal. Has that been your experience?
Yes. Yes. Yes, and the other difficulty is that, and you're sort of hinting at there, that, yeah, the association with illegal pets and other illegal situations and crime and you know, my throwaway line with that is, you know, I love my kneecaps and dealing with potentially a stereotypical, you know, illegal pet owner, maybe somebody who you don't really want to get on the wrong side of, Mark. So it adds another complicating layer, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yes, it does.
Well, I'd love to hear from our listeners, Mark, if they've had any experience with illegal pets and especially their owners, Mark, vetgurus@gmail.com. And we can deal with that anonymously if you don't want to, you know, we certainly won't call out people's names on our podcast unless they want to, but we'd love to hear some experiences and some thoughts on how to deal with this, both for your own mental health and your staff's mental health, and also for the concerns with illegal pets, Mark. And with that, we're out of here. Sorry, Mark, we're out of here. We'll talk to you all next week.
Thanks for listening to the Vet Podcast by the Vet Gurus. Don't forget to visit us at the website vetgurus.com, where you can subscribe, view show notes, listen to previous episodes and more. You can contact us via email at vetgurus@gmail.com to ask a question or just say hi. Thanks again and see you next time.